15th, 2017, the Aspuji Induction of Hawaii. So I wanted to speak today about the fact that this observance of the anniversary of the appearance in this world of Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada is a day for us to rededicate ourselves to him. And I want to talk a little bit about how we dedicate ourselves to Guru. I mean, the concept of Guru is actually not a very difficult concept in any field of knowledge or activity. It's basically impossible for us human beings to make any progress without some sort of guide or teacher. I mean, we're all born completely ignorant, and children who are raised away from human beings through some abuse or bad circumstance, they don't even learn language. You know, we're dependent on guides and teachers for everything. I mean, you can't just even study a medical book and become a doctor. You know, you have to train under a doctor. So even just self-study, you could say self-study where you're still learning from somebody, you still have some sort of guide in the form of the author of the book. But then without a teacher, it's not very effective. There's a book I finished reading recently about something called deliberate practice, and it was about how pretty much anybody, putting aside maybe some certain physical characteristics, but pretty much anybody can learn to become an expert in pretty much anything. And that a lot of what we call talent is really just people doing a lot of hard work. And of course there's predilection in the sense of what are we attracted to do hard work for. You know, somebody may be willing to do hard work to be a baseball player, and another person has no interest in doing hard work to be a baseball player. So there's some kind of nature in that regard. But primarily expertise was from nurture. And the kind of practice that works is not just doing something over and over again, because that just makes permanent. They say practice makes perfect, but it doesn't. If you're practicing the wrong way, you're practicing the wrong thing, you can go on and on and on and on and on, and you'll never become perfect. So deliberate practice involves some sort of a coach or mentor or teacher who knows what needs to be done in order to progress and who is giving you feedback. You know, I was noticing this when my daughter's a dance teacher, and I've been watching some of her dance classes, and she'll be doing that. She'll be saying, okay, you know, you're pretending to throw a ball, but if you're doing it like this, it's not going to work. You have to have your eye go to the ball. You have to have something in your mind. So she's looking at the minutia of what the person is doing, and she's giving them feedback. Oh, that's right. Yeah, you got the right... No, you got to move over this way. And having practice where you have a mentor and a guide is the only way to become expert pretty much in anything. So the same applies to the spiritual. And this is true even though spirituality... I was just listening to a lecture of Srila Prabhupada this morning where he was making this point that spiritual perfection is already there in each of us. It's not something to be gained from another source. It's not really something that's gifted from another source. It's already there. But it's already there, just like we have a plant here in a pot. So that plant was already there in the seed. Everything for the plant, well, but not everything. It was already there in potential, but yet there had to be a gift of sunlight and water and minerals for the plant to grow. And this is kind of the mystery. You know, if we're going to say, does our spiritual development... is it just something innate that doesn't need any outside source? Or does it need an outside source? And it's exactly like saying, if you have a mango seed, is everything in the mango seed or does it need an outside source? And both is true. Everything is in the seed. And at the same time, without an outside source, there's no tree. There's no tree. And if you look we've all looked at a mango seed, when you look at it, you don't see a tree. Right? You don't see like a little miniature tree. You used to think in Western science that the human embryo, you know, that at fertilization it was a fully developed person. It was just really tiny. Mm-hmm. Right? And it got really... But it's not. It's not. You know, the little seed, you don't see the organs and the forms. You know, and that all has to manifest by something from outside, even though all the DNA and the instructions are all there. So it's very much like that. Without instructions from a master, without guidance from a master, without the grace of a master, our innate spirituality just simply doesn't develop. It just doesn't develop. You know, can it develop by chance without that? Maybe, in some rare circumstances in history, that sometimes happens. But basically it doesn't happen. It basically just doesn't happen. Just like sometimes, you know, they do excavation, archaeologists, and they find, you know, chickpeas that are 5,000 years old. And they haven't sprouted. You know, they're just, the potential is there. And then when you put them in the sun and the water, then they sprout. And it's the pleasure of the master. And again, this is it's a very practical thing. You know, what is going to please a dance teacher, or what's going to please a medical teacher, is when you're doing well in the science. It's not something whimsical. It's not like when we say everything's dependent on the pleasure of guru. That doesn't mean that it's just some whimsical thing. I like green, so if you wear green, I'm happy, and then you become spiritually advanced. It's not like that. It's that the pleasure of the master is to see our potential unfold. I mean, we see this with parents. You know, most parents, their pleasure is to see the children become who they are and become happy and realize their nature and their potential. That's what makes them happy. So in that way, we say that the pleasure of one's spiritual master is the key, is the entire key to spiritual advancement. Now, again, that gets misused. We've seen so many people misuse that kind of thing, and you just have to do what pleases me, and then you'll get spiritual advancement. And so I think there's a strong tendency in our modern society against authority in general. You know, we threw out all the kings of Europe, and we have democracy. Thank God we have democracy. You know, and we're all hoping, I hope our democracy saves us. But there's a general mood against authority. And it's growing, growing, growing. You know, when I was growing up, a woman was called by her husband's not only last name, but first name. You know, it would be Sam Smith and Mrs. Sam Smith. And that. There were all these laws. I mean, even in the 60s and 70s, there were all these laws where women were very much under the authority of their husbands, and that's finished. Or children being under the authority of their parents, even, or teachers. So I was a teacher for many years, and the way that parents treated me and the way my parents treated teachers was radically different. So there's a general mood against authority and the concept that our spirituality is dependent on having some kind of a master. I mean, the word master, a spiritual master, I have to have a master. you know, we have our, in the Hare Krishna movement, we have our behavior that whenever we write a letter to someone, we sign it, "You're a servant." You know, but just the concept of being a servant is so repulsive in modern society. You know, I can't think of very many parents in the United States saying to their children, "Please grow up and be a servant." And practically anywhere in the world, for somebody to say, you know, "I want my child to grow up and be a servant." So this concept that I have a master and I'm a servant, when we were first translating, actually, Srila Prabhupada translated his books. He wrote so many books, 800 books, something like that. But almost all of his books were translations. It was translations and commentaries. And then these were translated into other languages. And when they were first translated into Russian, the Russians translated it instead of servant as slave. Well, you know, even then, many hundreds of people took up Krishna consciousness, even with books like that. But we have this kind of concept. I don't want anyone as my master. Okay, you can be a teacher, but you can be a teacher in the sense that I'll take guidance from you when I want, and you know, more like someone I'm consulting with, and I can pick a little from here and a little from there. And then, of course, when we do that, ultimately we become our own teacher. You know, say someone who has himself for a teacher has a fool for a disciple. Mm-hmm. So you know, that's as soon as we absolutely rebel against the idea of having a master, then we're setting ourselves up as our own master. And the problem with that is that, bless you, that we can fool ourselves. You know, we need someone to say, "You're getting hotter, you're getting colder, you're getting hotter, you're getting colder." And we need someone to give us transcendent knowledge that we can know that there is a God, and we can know that there's spirituality just with a little intelligence. Just like we know that somebody made this rug, and that the person who made this rug was over the age of 2 when they were a human being. I mean, that's, you know, the archaeologists, they've got to be able to look at a rock and see, is this just a rock, or is it a stone tool? And there's signs you can tell if there's some intelligence. So we can look at the world and we can see that there's intelligence. We can see that there's order, but yet there's surprises. You know, there's order and there's surprises. There's seeming paradoxes. There's beauty. There's love. There's variety. So we can understand all of that. But to understand what is the actual nature, just like I can see something about the mood of the maker of this rug, but I don't really know, you know, is it a man or a woman? Is the person 20? Is it, are they 40? You know, do they live in Iraq or do they live in Syria? I don't really know. You know, I certainly don't know what they like to eat for breakfast just by looking at the rug. I have to meet them, or I have to meet someone who knows them. So the spiritual master also gives us information that's beyond our senses. Of course, that requires, all of this requires some trust. That requires a tremendous amount of trust, that we have a master who will guide us properly for our benefit, who's not self-motivated, and who actually has knowledge. So we in the Hare Krishna movement are convinced that A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada is such a master, and I'm not going to try in a few minutes today to convince anybody of that, especially our new guests. I'd say if you want to decide whether or not you want to be convinced of that, that you study his books and his teachings and you try his process and experiment with it and make a decision for yourself. There's many, many books about Srila Prabhupada's life. Most of them detail Srila Prabhupada's life between 1965 and 1977, which was the time that he came out of India initially to America and started the Hare Krishna movement. So most of the people writing biographies of his life were writing of when he was here with us rather than before that. But there are also some books of Prabhupada's life before that. So I wanted to, with that sort of as a framework, I wanted to talk a little bit about having this day as a day of rededication to our spiritual master. And this is aimed primarily at those of us who are already dedicated. So those of you who are guests, I hope you'll simply try to appreciate our attempt at rededication.
Thank you.
So, I was thinking about rededication in three areas, in our actions, in our minds, and in our hearts. And in each of those, I was looking at three sub-areas in terms of love and surrender and service. So in terms of our actions, to dedicate our actions to our spiritual master in terms of practical behavior and practical service, this would mean a dedication to Srila Prabhupada's mission. And Srila Prabhupada's mission was to bring all the world to a state of ultimate consciousness, which is love of God, a personal love of God. That was his mission. And Srila Prabhupada would say many times that he was not trying to convert people from one religion to another. He was not trying to change people from being Christians to being Hindus, for example. But he was trying to get everybody to love God. And of course, he was presenting a very particular concept of God. He was presenting God as a person, and the person Krishna, who is a cowherd. I mean, sometimes Jesus is represented metaphorically as a shepherd. Jesus worked as a carpenter. He didn't work as a shepherd, although he's sometimes called the shepherd. But we're speaking about God literally as a cowherd. And he not only herds cows, he also herds other animals, goats and buffaloes. A keeper of animals in this pastoral setting. And these are not ordinary animals. These are realized saints who take those forms for an exchange of love. And so Srila Prabhupada would like to have everyone come to a consciousness of God and a love of God, and particularly of God in this form. Although Prabhupada would say, if you have some other understanding of God, you may also do that. And he wanted to do that primarily through the writing, translating, and distribution of sacred literature. So the sacred literature of India, much of which is at least thousands of years old, some which is more recent in our tradition, say hundreds of years old. And he also wanted us to write our own books and distribute them. And he wanted us to distribute his translations and commentary on the books, and also to produce more and more translations. So this is a time, but by our actions, we can say, what can I do for the books? Can I write? Can I translate? Can I donate for someone else to translate? Can I arrange for the books to get out? What can I do to get the books out in the mission? And what can I do to read and study these books, not as an academic exercise and not as a way of gaining information, but as a way really to transform my heart? Also part of his mission was worship. And for that, he established so many temples all over the world. And so to what extent am I worshiping? Am I doing worship every day? In what mood am I worshiping? Am I helping others to engage in worship? And then another part of his mission was simple living. And when Srila Prabhupada first came in the 1960s, the concept of simple living was a very new idea in Western society. In fact, it was kind of an antisocial idea. You know, in those days, we would see advertisements on the television, better living through chemistry. Many of you are old enough to remember that. And the concept was that modern technology and chemistry was going to save the world. I mean, I remember watching this show on TV, Star Trek, where they were traveling the universe and the computer was synthesizing food. It was all synthetic because they didn't have a garden in their spaceship. It was all created by the computer. And we thought that was wonderful. You know, we're like, wow, synthetic food. And the, you know, prepared chemical food. Like, you know, DDT had eliminated malaria in a lot of the world. And I'm in the middle of reading a book called The Alchemy of Air, how synthetic fertilizer was first developed by pulling the nitrogen out of the air. And this was amazing. We could get synthetic fertilizer and pesticides. And we were really, the world was into this, and the Green Revolution was just starting in the 60s. So this, when Srila Prabhupada was preaching simple living, go back to the land, keep cows, grow your own food, live in harmony with nature. Now, that's very much mainstream, but in that time it was extremely revolutionary. And just to the max. So that when I went as a teenager, my granddaughter said, I was 15, when I was out on protest marches in favor of the environment, you know, we would be attacked by the police. So what are we doing for simple living? How am I living more simply in my own life? How am I teaching simple living in the world? How am I helping people to go back to that? And then educating people, schools for children, schools for adults, classes online, classes in person. How am I helping people? And then distributing sanctified vegetarian food. So, of course, the Hare Krishna movement is very famous for this. And not only food that's free of meat, fish, and eggs, but food that's also offered to the Lord with love. And how am I cooking? How am I eating? With what consciousness am I eating? And am I also sharing this food? So that in the mood of dedicating our actions in service. Then dedicating our actions in surrender. I thought this is actually very difficult because Srila Prabhupada asked us to do actions which were very much against the grain of most of the world. When we became his disciples, we vowed no eating of meat, fish, or eggs, no intoxication, even to tea and coffee and cigarettes, no illicit sex, and no gambling. And then we vowed also to chant on our beads, 108 beads, 16 times a day, the Hare Krishna mantra, which takes an hour and a half, 2 hours a day for meditation. I remember when I gave classes, highlight of my life was when I gave classes on Krishna consciousness to Southern Baptist ministers. And when I told them that we spent about 2 hours every day in meditation, they're like, oh, I wish we did that. But having that surrender, that this is the instruction of Srila Prabhupada. It's the instruction of Srila Prabhupada. And therefore, I'm going to do it, even if it's inconvenient, even if it's difficult. You know, it's something that I'm going to do. And I'm going to do it every day. And I'm going to accept following these four rules and chanting, spending that time in chanting and meditation with a high level of quality, no matter how busy I am, no matter how many other things are going on. You know, and Srila Prabhupada would say to disciples, I know you're really busy if you don't eat or sleep. And he said, you know, if you're eating and sleeping, then you're not too busy for your time for prayer and meditation. And but that's action in the mood of surrender. surrender to a master again, it's not just something sentimental. Again, going to my daughter as a dance teacher, so she can always tell whether or not her students are practicing regularly, right? So it's always obvious, right, whether or not they're practicing. So in the same way, I'm sure that to Srila Prabhupada is obvious whether or not we're really practicing, and that time of chanting on beads is our main time of just connection with Krishna. I always think of it like my father every day. He was a busy man. He was the CEO of an international corporation. He was the president of a Jewish synagogue. He was a very busy man. But every morning he'd take an hour and a half, 2 hours a day just to be with me, to tell me stories, to play games with me, to make my breakfast, which he didn't cook. That meant like toasting some bread, squeezing oranges. But, you know, am I surrendering to that? And this is surrendering to both accepting and rejecting. You know, do I, with my actions, give up those things that Srila Prabhupada said would be harmful to me spiritually? And do I accept those things which would be beneficial to me spiritually, even when it's hard? Even when I don't necessarily want to in the moment, and even when there's other things pressing on me. And then actions in terms of love. So love means, according to one of our acharyas, one of our teachers who lived hundreds of years ago, he explained the definition of love is where my happiness is the other person's happiness. Generally in this world, people use each other for their own happiness. I once read the definition of a jerk is they see everyone else as a tool or a fool. And looking at that, I thought, to what extent am I a jerk? You know, to what extent do we see people as just tools for our own happiness? And if they're not a very good tool for my own happiness, then they're a fool. You know, then what a foolish person. They're not willing to work for my happiness. And in that way, we see other people basically as objects rather than as living beings. You know, we see them like, I have a computer that's meant to serve me. I don't need to care about whether or not my computer is happy because my computer doesn't have any feelings. So love is when I really care about the other person's feelings, and where I care about the other person's feelings, not just to manipulate them so they're going to care about me, but I genuinely care about their feelings for them. And I have happiness through them. When I see they are happy, I become happy. So to what extent are my actions motivated by that love, ultimately for God, and that love for my master, that I want him to be happy? I want him to be happy with what I'm doing, not so that I'll think, oh yes, now I'm a very good person. You know, if the teacher says, okay, you did that, right? Yes, yes, I agree. But, oh, I got to please my teacher. My teacher's happy. So that mood of love in our actions. Then I'm going to look at mind. So mind in service to make plans. How can I serve the mission of my master? How can I be an assistant? And Srila Prabhupada says that this thinking is the cure for ordinary lust. He said ordinary lust is lust is not just sexual. It making plans is how I can satisfy my senses, which is what most people spend their time doing. How can I make money? How can I attract people? How can other people honor me? How can I be comfortable? How can I get this? How can I get that? So instead to make plans, how can I push on my master's mission? How can I actually please my master? How can I please God? And that way our mind to be absorbed in that. And then for our mind to be surrendered. And I personally find this, just frankly, the most difficult. Ramananda introduced me as a scholar. So being my whole life an intellectual, it's very, very difficult for me to just accept something. I always want to find out what's wrong with it. Thankfully, I have one of my hobbies is as a magazine editor, where I get to look at other people's writings and tear them into shreds. Thank you that I have that outlet for being hypercritical. So that's my tendency. My tendency is to look at anything that's intellectual and philosophical and find out what's wrong with it and tear it up into pieces and find out all the faults with it. I had a whole wall of trophies for debate. So for me to look at the teachings of my master and not do that, for me, speaking for me, is a surrender of the mind to not want to just say, oh, well, he must be wrong about this, and he must be wrong about this, and he must be wrong about this, and he must be wrong about this. But instead to say, all right, well, what is being said here? How does it make sense? Right? Even in our normal human interactions, and I can speak from experience, if you interact with another human being and you're always trying to tear apart what they're saying and what they believe in, they're not going to be very happy with you. Whereas if you try to think about their internal processes and how, what are they saying, what do they mean? You know, what are their, what's meaning are they trying to communicate? And this is something Srila Prabhupada made a point of a lot, that if you want to understand something, you have to ask the person who wrote it or who said it. You can't just guess what they mean. So surrender of the mind is for me to try to understand what Srila Prabhupada intends with what he's saying. What is he trying to communicate? And I find that whenever I do that, I find his teachings very coherent, very consistent, very enlivening. And then love in the mind. So to use the mind to read about Srila Prabhupada, to read about his activities, to meditate on his activities and his qualities for inspiration. Then I wanted to go to the heart. So service in the heart, and this is the ultimate service. And this is to be open in the heart to correction. And I really believe that the hardest thing for anybody to do is to genuinely open their heart to correction. It's one thing to have someone correct your behavior, even that, we really don't like having our behavior corrected. You know, even when we pay a teacher, you know, fix my tennis swing or whatever, it's very hard to accept correction about behavior. It's extremely difficult. Harder than that is to accept correction about an idea that something we believe to be true is wrong. That is extremely difficult. You know, even something just so simple. So my daughter-in-law, most of her kids have already moved to Seattle. We have two girls. We're going to move in a couple weeks. And she left a vehicle to sell, and I told her the vehicle's registration and safety check has expired. And she says, no, I'm sure I did it. And so it was like an hour that she's arguing with me that she did it. And finally I just went out, I took pictures of the license plate, and I took pictures of the registration, I just took pictures and I sent it to her, and then she said, oh, you're right. And I was thinking, you know, most of us are like this, that, you know, I have a wrong idea, I remember something wrong, we just fight it and fight it and fight it. But what to speak of something about our character? If we fight about a behavior and we fight about an idea that we always have to be right, what about our intentions? I mean, what just devastates us is having to admit that our intentions are evil, that our intentions are selfish. Because our general way of thinking is, all right, maybe sometimes I have the wrong opinion. Maybe. Possibly once or twice in a year, maybe. And maybe once or twice in a month I do a wrong behavior. Okay, but my intentions are pristine. That is beyond question. Nobody can touch my intentions. And a spiritual master, frankly, is not so interested in behavior and opinions. You know, what we could call in the pejorative way, ritual and belief. Yeah, he's not that interested in what rituals you do and what you believe. He's interested. He's definitely interested. They're important. But that's not his primary interest. His primary interest is in changing one's motivation, is in changing one's character, is in changing one's heart. And wow, you know, we don't want to do that. It's easy to take up some spiritual process, relatively, and change one's belief and change one's practices. Even that's very difficult, but that's relatively easy compared to saying, okay, do open heart surgery. You know, I'm willing to have you actually look in my heart. And I will say very frankly that if I had understood that taking up Krishna consciousness meant that I was going to have to look in my heart and address those kind of things, I would not have even started. I really wouldn't have. And if I had known what that actually meant, I don't think I would have done it. At the same time, I take the risk of telling people from the beginning, hey, that's what it's going to involve. And the sooner you get down to that, the better. If you just stick on the level of rituals and beliefs and you try to set up your life that way, and I've got all the rituals perfectly and I've got all the beliefs perfectly, it says in the Bhagavad Gita it's going to take you lifetimes. not just lifetimes, many Bahunam Janmanamante. It's going to be very long, long, long. And if you're willing to look in the heart from day one. But it is hard. It is very hard. And I, again, speaking for myself, whenever my heart is looked at, my initial response to that is always to fight. You know, it may take an hour or two or a day before I'll go, yeah, let's deal with that. It's very difficult not to have that initial, no, I am pristine. Everything I do is well-intentioned. So that is at the level of service of the heart. And then surrender of the heart. To actually be aware of Prabhupada's motives. What is his heart? How is he thinking? Not just to look at his teachings in terms of, do they make sense to me intellectually, which I found that they do. But what is Srila Prabhupada's motive? Where is he coming from? What is his intention? And to come to appreciate that here is a person who doesn't have any evil intentions. And then love in the heart, to be open to appreciating and gratitude for Srila Prabhupada and for everyone and for everything. So I was looking at actions and mind and heart in terms of service and surrender and love, and how I'm hoping to dedicate myself on this day to my spiritual master. I'm sure that I will do a far less than perfect job of that, but at least I want to make some steps. And as one fellow disciple was speaking last night at the anniversary of Krishna's appearance, he was saying, you know, as we go on in our practice, and he wasn't talking just about rituals, as we go on in our practice, he said, we should constantly be striving to go deeper. He said, when we get a plateau, he said, kick it and go further and go further. So I'm hoping at least some little step in that direction. So thank you for asking me to speak. I hope it didn't go too long.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hare Krishna.
So generally what we do